You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It's August 24th, 2023. It's 7:35 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And one of the things that's been coming up quite a bit in my work with people is the dilemma of what do you do when a relationship is not regulating. It's one of those beasts, really, I think, because there's so little that you can really do about it, except in the beginning, when you're forming the relationship, examine that and make sure that the person is reliably regulating. Because once you get way down the road, it's harder to, you're more invested in the relationship and it's harder to come to terms with that. It's also can be frustrating for both people in the relationship because most of the time you'd like to be able to do it. And then when you can't do it, it can cause a cascade of responses. So what exactly do we mean by this idea that somebody is emotionally regulating and somebody who might not be emotionally regulating? Most of the thoughts I have about this come from Alan Shore's research into the nature of emotions. He wrote a trilogy of books that is, see if I can pull up the names of them as I say that, were related to the emotional experience and emotional experience of self. Affect regulation, I think, is the one in 2003 that got me started on this. And then he wrote a book called Affect Dysregulation. So the whole picture is there, also in 2003. We have these autonomic, unconscious systems of connecting with each other. And the way that we do that, if there's good integration and the systems are compatible, then it produces the effect of a mutual co-regulating experience. This operates through the empathetic experience of each other. I'm going to talk about this in simplistic terms, so don't get mad at me if I make it too simple, but I do want you to be able to understand, and I'm not sure all of the aspects of neuroscience and all of the aspects of this and that that gets added to the bloodstream that creates all these experiences is so important. But what you need to know is that when you encounter somebody, this unconscious automatic process happens where you connect to them. And sometimes when these two systems are attempting to integrate, there's an experience of linking that produces emotional regulation in each other. Three choices, simply talking about this. Do you feel more regulated? Do you feel less regulated? Do you feel the same? So one of the things to pay attention to in relationships with people, and this is because this is unconscious and not about the exchange of ideas, the conversation that you might be having, is just when the bodies link, when the bodies are in proximity to each other, does that have an effect that's agitating? Does not much happen? Or do you notice that you feel better? You know, you can feel better and they can feel worse. It's not this mutual magic that always happens. There's the possibilities. You feel better, they feel the same. You feel better, they feel worse. You feel better, they feel better. That's what you're looking for. They feel better, you feel worse. They feel better, you feel the same. You both feel neutral. You both feel worse. So those are the kinds of combinations that you have. And you have these experiences pretty much with everybody that you encounter. And so part of this process of developing your mentalizing is to develop it in such a way that you can track this, and also that you begin to value it. The reason that this is so important is that you want people around you that can reliably emotionally regulate you when you get dysregulated. And if you don't have people around you, then you're going to be looking for other kinds of strategies, auto-regulating strategies, substances, behaviors. All of those things are what get engaged when you don't have reliable people to regulate you. You can regulate with somebody else in 15 or 20 minutes from a distressing experience to pretty much settled, whereas without somebody who's an efficient co-regulator, the dysregulation can go on for hours, sometimes longer. The only way to avoid the stimulation that can be dysregulating without reliable co-regulators is to withdraw from stimulating behavior, withdraw from stimulating activities. And so what you'll notice in a lot of people is that if they're unable to form relationships that have this component of reliable regulation, they begin to limit the risks that they take in life so that they're not knocked off balance and have no solution to being knocked off balance. In the beginning, with relationships, I like to say the thing that you need to focus on above everything else is, are they consistently, reliably regulating? That each time you're with them for 20 or 30 minutes, do you feel better? And if you don't feel better, then you want to understand that that relationship is not going to be able to provide for you this fundamental value of being somebody who can catch you when you get knocked out of sorts. Is that making sense? Most people who don't find that somebody is regulating for them, most people are not willing to put a lot of energy into that relationship because it doesn't have that safety net quality built into it. The purpose of close relationships are really the safety net for your exploration. You want people that are interested in what you find interesting, that are encouraging of you to pursue the things that have meaning for you, are excited to hear about what you found out when you went out and explored, but also people who are able to bring you back into emotional balance if going out there and trying to find out things causes you to get emotionally distressed. And the more of those people and the more available they are to you, the bigger risks that you can take in terms of your exploration, because a great emotional upset is much less a big deal if you have people who can catch you and bring you back into balance than it is if you don't have anybody to catch you. What do you think about that, taking risks? If we use the high wire metaphor, going up on the high wire, and if you had a reliable safety net that could catch you in any condition, how much easier would that be than if you had no net? So you find somebody who's regulating, and the next thing you need to know is, are you regulating for them? And it's the same process of determining reliably your ability to regulate somebody else. When you find somebody who's regulating for you and you're regulating for them, we also have to begin to see this as something valuable, something to pay attention to, something to nurture, something to put the resources into to be able to maintain. Which brings us to this next piece. You're reliable for them. They're reliable for you. How do they like to be taken care of? I always like to start with how do they like to be taken care of? Because if you don't enjoy taking care of them in the way that they need to be taken care of, it's unlikely that you'll do enough of it. If taking care of somebody is a chore, it doesn't really matter whether they're regulating or not, because you won't do enough of it and they won't feel taken care of. And so there'll be conflict in the relationship constantly because you're not following through on the things that you need to do. So there needs to be a thorough exploration of how do they like to be taken care of? And is it something that you can do, feel confident in doing, and also be willing to do enough that they feel settled and taken care of? Then you have to find out whether they like to take care of you in the way that you need to be taken care of, because if they don't take care of you, you won't feel taken care of, and you'll also complain about that. So I think of those as the preliminary basis of relationship. You're regulating for them, they're regulating for you consistently. You enjoy taking care of them, and they enjoy taking care of you. Then you can look at whether or not you're good traveling companions. So traveling companions means that the way that you want to live your life and the way that they want to live their lives line up enough that it makes sense that you would do that together rather than lives that are so different that it there isn't an obvious a way in which they would fit together. And then there's all sorts of ways in which to form relationships, from the you know, rigorously monogamous to the rigorously polygamous. And that also tends to be just part of your nature. Are you reactive to the experience of someone who is engaged on multiple fronts, or are you not reactive to that? And what do you want to do? And can you line that up with somebody else so that it makes sense for you to travel together? So this also takes time. I would say that 2 or 3 months of hanging out regularly would be the minimum needed to establish whether or not somebody's reliably regulating for you. And one of the things that interferes with that is abandonment terror. We get frightened as we get attached to somebody that they might leave us. And one of the ways that we regulate that experience is by rushing in and overcommitting too quickly without really knowing the person well enough to know whether or not they can show up in a way that's meaningful over a period of time. You want to be able to see somebody in the way that they operate in a range of different situations so that you have a range of experiences to know how reliable they're going to be. One of the things about secure functioning relationships is that they're very reliable. One of the experiences that insecure and disorganized people have about the reliability of secure functioning relationships is it seems boring, at least initially. There's no highs and lows, you know, there's no exhilaration that they showed up, there's no devastation that they didn't. And all of that energy that gets consumed by stabilizing the relationship actually has to come from somewhere. And most of the time, it comes from the energy that's available for your exploration. And so people who are poor explorers almost prefer relationships that consume all of the energy so that they have an internal excuse not to explore that is compelling. But it also puts you in a place where there isn't enough meaning. We do not actually find the fulfillment of life, the meaningfulness of life, from being in a relationship with someone else. We find it from exploring. And what we want to do to have a rich and meaning-filled life is spend a lot of time exploring and pursuing the things that have meaning. But if you consume all of the energy that you could use for exploration and stabilizing the relationships that you have around you, that meaning is absent. And so one of the things about secure relationships, which are settled and stable, is there's not a lot of energy that's necessary to re-stabilize them. You still have to put a lot of energy into supporting the relationships and investing in the care of the other person. But you don't have to consume energy constantly restabilizing the relationship, which is what happens with insecure and disorganized relationships. You make an agreement. The agreement works for both people in the relationship, and both people in the relationship keep the agreement. And so that issue settles and drops out of a need for constant stabilization. Then that energy that isn't used for the stabilization is available for exploration, and you can pursue that. Because you have in place people that can catch you, you don't have to concern yourself when you're out exploring about not risking too much. That would be emotionally dysregulating. You can go for it and then see what happens. And then if you do need regulation, it's reliably available to you. And so you just come back and get it, restabilize, and then go back out. It's a very different way of being. I started this by saying, in the couples work that I do, most of the difficulties that cause relationships to fail that I experience is this inability of one person to feel regulated, or the inability of one person to regulate the other person. It creates a sense of helplessness in the person who can't do it. And it creates a despair in the person who's not regulated. Christian?
Does that map onto a particular attachment dynamic, or is that be sort of beyond, like, just dismissing with preoccupied, say?
I don't notice that it fits into an attachment pattern. I do notice that when people are dysregulated and can't get their partner to regulate them, it activates their attachment patterning. So whatever that patterning is in the relationship activates.
So do you find that with secure people, they would have already noticed that this regulation was not a component of the relationship, and they wouldn't have gone further? Or does it also happen with secure people?
I've noticed it happen in all of the different attachment constellations. What happens is you meet somebody and they make a good traveling companion, and so you skip over the preliminaries. Something about them is appealing. You know, we have the glow. I like to talk about the glow. The glow is actually what happens when you see somebody who matches the pattern of the care that you got in childhood. The eyes actually dilate, so they become very bright and shiny. But that doesn't last that long, maybe a few months. And then, of course, when the glow is gone, you have the person that was always there. And the glow, they think the glow is to create a smoothness to that initial period of getting to know somebody, because you have to make all of these agreements with people once you meet them, so that the relationship functions well. And that's the idea of negotiating something, coming up with an agreement that works for both people and settling it. And in the beginning, when you just meet somebody, there's a lot to do. And so the glow sort of slides you over the top of that. Long enough, hopefully, that you can get some basic agreements in place and that supports the relationship. So maybe it's the glow that's pulling you towards somebody, or maybe you just find somebody interesting and you like talking to them. I notice this issue of regulation is not based on whether you like somebody or not. You could not like somebody particularly, and they could be very good at regulating. Or you could really like somebody and they are just dysregulating. Every time you're with them, you're really engaged by their mind, by their interests, by the you like the quality of the conversation, but you feel dysregulated after. Christian.
You have an example that you've seen or someone that you've encountered that of someone that either one person doesn't like, but they find them dysregulating, or I guess if you knew someone that you didn't like, but you found dysregulating, sorry, you found regulating, but you didn't like. I'm curious how that might look.
I have lots of examples of people I don't like that are quite regulating for me. So I'm just wondering. The thought that came to mind was when I was 18, I was just sort of hitching around the world, and I was in southern Morocco. I don't know if you know Morocco at all, but there's a small town in southern Morocco called Tiznit, which is right near the edge of the Sahara Desert. And we were wintering in a small place called Milaf, and I met somebody there, and I thought he was a complete asshole, but he was very regulating. I mean, I could spend a half an hour with him, and I would be fine and actually kind of happy and buoyant. But I could see that everybody else around him was reacting like he was a complete jerk. And he was a complete jerk. And eventually the jerkiness overwhelmed the regulation. And he ended up departing with a significant portion of my cash. But the experience of spending time with him was very regulating. But the first example that came to mind. The idea then is to begin to pay attention to whether you're regulated or not, and then see who it's associated with and whether you like them or whether you don't. Just because they're regulating doesn't mean you want to form a relationship with them. Edward?
Yeah, well, we've all heard about, she married five alcoholics in a row, and lo and behold, dad was an alcoholic, and I married the same woman with five different hairstyles, and that kind of thing, So, I mean, you're trying to, I mean, the psychological explanation, as far as I know, is that you're trying to get closure on a primary relationship that wasn't very good, perhaps. And so I don't know where the glow comes in on this, if it does at all, but how would you relate that dynamic to what you're talking about?
The repetition compulsion? Which is
choosing a dysfunctional person because they match the person that, a caregiver, and you're trying to get closure or what's going on there,
Well, we all do that pretty much all the time with everybody. We're our patterns, our conditioning creates the way that we understand the world, and then people fit into that framework. And if you don't actively mentalize it and understand whether it's useful or not, and begin to replace the strategies that aren't useful, then you really do look for people whose system of relationship is compatible enough to your way of being that you can form a relationship. As to whether or not we can assign the motivation of trying to solve the current relationship, solve the past relationship through the current relationship, it's certainly a theory. I can tell you that even if you do solve it in the current relationship, it doesn't solve the past relationship. So it's not fruitful in that way.
Yeah, a couple other things quickly is the attachment assessment interview. I guess you're going to give some kind of class in that. Now that would be obviously be helpful for a therapist to be able to do that. But studying that would help me assess what my attachment style is and maybe what to do about it, as well as in terms of perspective, you know, regulators, you know, what theirs is, you know. So that's, I guess, is that correct? And I just want to say, I lost an election in fifth grade and I cried, and boys don't cry, right? And I wanted my mother to comfort me, and she couldn't, you know, she didn't have anything to say to me. And so, you know, I mean, that was pretty devastating, and I don't know what that led to. I mean, does that make me, you know, dismissed or preoccupied, or I mean, there were many things, obviously, or does that make me, you know, what's the other one? You know, or I mean, there's more. Yeah. Anyway, so anything you have to say about any of that?
Well, I'm sorry you lost the election. So one of the things that happens in childhood, if you have caregivers that aren't able to regulate you, which is not an uncommon thing, is then you don't have a sense that the world is filled with people who can. So that's one of the reasons why we don't investigate whether somebody's reliably regulating, because you don't have the historical experiences of people reliably regulating us. And that's why we develop strategies often that are not people oriented to regulate, because there aren't reliable regulators. And so you can get quite a long way down the road in a relationship with somebody who isn't regulating, because it's not something that you consider that can happen. And I think that the reason I'm talking about this evening is largely because of that. We don't even consider it, or we don't know to consider it, and so we don't. And then we get down the road on a relationship, or really committed into a relationship, and that fundamental quality is absent. It's not, you know, catastrophic unless it's accompanied by the refusal of the apartment of your partner to allow other regulators into the relational system. You know, Robin Dunbar's research showed that in the West, the most common way that adults organize their relationship is they have one A relationship. Mm-hmm. They put 40% of the relational energy into that, and they have no inner circle, and they have C relationships, so more casual relationships. They put 60% of their relational energy into that. But when you're in that dyadic relationship and there's conflicts in the relationships, a lot of times the partner does not want, one partner does not want the other partner to discuss it with anyone. And so they restrict the access of a regulator to their partner, because it creates a conflict either around jealousy or around a violation of the sense of the monogamy of the relationship. And so then you're in a bind with somebody who doesn't really regulate you when you're distressed, and actually doesn't permit you to seek other relationships that would be regulated. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you were in a relationship where you were permitted to form regulating relationships, that might stabilize it a little. Dunbar did say that 1.5 is the number. 1.5 A's make the most stable primary relationship, which is that one or both partners have permission of the other partner to discuss completely freely what's happening in the relationship so that there's more perspective and more balance. Whereas the relationships where it's that's not permitted, the pressure of the relationship can build up to the point that it's damaging to the relationship.
I didn't get that 1.5 A's. I'm not quite clear. I think that's what an A is.
A relationship is a primary relationship where you take care of them on a daily or every other day basis.
Yeah.
And a couple of things about an A relationship. One is that the A relationship is private. You don't really have permission to discuss anything that happens in the relationship with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And the needs of the relationship take precedence over your individual exploration. So that if it's a choice between the needs of the relationship and your exploration, you always choose the relationship, not your individual exploration.
Mm-hmm.
But Dunbar found that in relationships where one or both people in the relationship have permission to discuss with one other person whatever happens in the relationship, that creates a spaciousness in the relationship that allows it to function better.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you can get, it's a perspective gaining experience, I think. It's easy to lose perspective when there's conflict. Richard?
Ed, it sounds like you missed your chance to storm the principal's office and have them overturn the election.
Well, I might add that I was called into the principal's office for the results of the election for secretary in fifth grade. And, you know, he said, sorry, Ed, you know, you lost, or Eddie, whatever, you lost. And I went back to class and I'm sitting there at the desk. And I broke down in tears, you know, in class. I just wish I'd gone home, you know, because not only, you know, was I disappointed, but, you know, I was, you know, shamed and embarrassed, you know, because like I say, you know, for boys, you know, boys don't cry. And nobody ever said anything to me, but I just assumed that, you know, hey, I'm a sissy now. And, you know, and it was just, and then, you know, my mother was not providing any consolation. My two sisters were, you know, they didn't know what to do, or they weren't aware, you know, so it was just, yeah, it was a real body blow. So I blew out the windows with cherry bombs.
Okay.
Full disclosure. No. It's past the statute of limitations now, I'm saying. I did act out a little bit, but not because of that, just because I was generally, I don't know.
George, I did have another question. I think this is maybe my misunderstanding for a long time. I had understood you to be saying, like when you sort of talked about this glow, that when you do the attachment work, when you do this work on yourself, eventually different people start to glow as you've shifted your attachment. But now I'm understanding that maybe that there's a different, there's kind of two different mechanisms at work, and they maybe do or don't always touch each other, but that maybe people who glow for you just kind of glow, and that's not really something you shift around.
No, I do think it changes. Dan Brown used to say that you can get the glow back in its full glory. But what I notice happening is that the insecure and disorganized traits of your family system as you earn security are no longer attractive. And so that people who exhibit them are not interesting. And that the people who exhibit more secure functioning and show up reliably, and one of the main ones is the aspect of delight, that they then become the draw, the thing that you're interested in. So maybe I'm just in a transitional period because I don't have much glow. People don't glow anymore. Who knows? Maybe it's age related.
You don't have cataracts, do you?
Cataracts. I do have cataracts.
Well, there you go.
They just told me at the optometrist that I should consider not driving at night, which is so bad enough to affect that, but not bad enough that they would do the surgery and replace them. So we'll see. An interim period. So I also am an advocate of slow dating. Slow dating is the term that's developing in the zeitgeist. That take, a year of getting to know somebody before you make substantial commitments to date multiple people at the same time, and go incrementally in terms of the amount of time, energy, and resources that you give to a relationship. This is really different than the way that I think that we've been brought up with, love at first sight and meeting the perfect person or the soulmate and rushing into these relationships. The thing that is important to understand about this is that relationships, when they fail, leave the consequence of disappointment. And as time goes on and you go through a succession of relationships that don't work out, the disappointment accumulates. And then at a certain point, it isn't that you no longer desire to be in relationships, that you no longer are interested in forming your social network, but that the disappointment of another failed relationship and the desire to avoid that disappointment becomes so great that you begin to withdraw from relationships. So you'll notice, particularly in disorganized people around the mid-30s, when so many relationships have failed, that they just begin to withdraw from forming relationships, and they can become quite socially isolated. Fearfully preoccupied people, because they don't monitor very well, are confused as to why the relationships don't work. And so even though they might internally consider that relationships desirable, the confusion and disappointment keeps them from trying. You have somebody who would like to try but can't bear the idea of the failure again, the confusion and the disappointment. Fearful avoidant people, it's a little bit different in the sense that they want to withdraw from relationships. What happens to them, particularly if there's been some kind of abuse in their childhoods where it wasn't sadistic and they were drawn into it through their natural attachment desires. When the relationships fail over and over again, it undermines their confidence in determining whether somebody will hurt them or not. And so when they become protective of themselves, which is a good thing, what they do is withdraw from relationships because their lack of confidence in being able to tell whether somebody will hurt them or not. Is that making sense? The disorganized relationships can be so chaotic and so resource intensive that it really can shake up a life. Inability to stabilize the relationships while you're actively engaged in them means that the only way that you can stabilize your life is by not engaging in them. So there's a withdrawal from relationships there. And once you get past your mid-30s or so, 7 out of 10 people who are single are dismissing, and they don't form a relationship so much. They're looking for somebody who will take care of them, and they don't reciprocate. And so they move from one relationship to the next pretty quickly. So what we want to do is begin to look at the systems of relationship that we inherited from our family group, analyze the skill sets, both good and bad, and then begin to drop the bad skills and push into the good skills, or the beneficial skills and the afflictive skills. Is that making sense? But the first place you start is this. Do I feel better? Do I feel the same? Do I feel worse? And for the first few months of knowing somebody, do I consistently feel better? That's the threshold that will take you into a relationship that has actually legs, that can go somewhere. If you don't pay attention to that and you don't insist that that be present, even though you can get into the relationship, it doesn't have a long way to run. Is that making sense? So let's do some heart practice. Again, I think maybe we'll do loving kindness practice for an easy person and then switch to loving kindness for self. So go ahead and settle into the body, taking your meditation posture, closing the eyes, scanning through the body, looking for any tension you might be holding, seeing if you can release it. All right, let go of the meditation. Any comments or questions about that?
Yeah, I was the other day, I was chose one woman and we were doing the mudita. And then this time I chose another woman and I was just noticing the changes of, and it was quite easy with the other woman, but with this one, maybe it's sort of a mother transference or something, because I was like, you know, there was, I was like a little worried about her, you know, and I was feeling a little selfish because after all, I'm supposed to be doing the loving kindness and yet I feel a little needy and, you know, and it's okay that she's changing her moods or whatever. And she's, and then I felt easier to do it toward myself. And then toward the very end, just, I thought of the term deity yoga, and maybe there's a connection between this kind of IPF and deity yoga. I don't know, but I heard something, but toward the end, I started to see a stability of the beauty, you know, and a lessening of the volatility of her mood or whatever. And I could see, you know, just this, you know, like this Kuan Yin figure sort of. And anyway, just interesting, you know.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
More on the view and less on the thinking.
Yeah, that near enemy, I could detect that when you mentioned that, because yeah, the anger, you know, I wasn't really in touch with, but the sentimentality and the thinking, and you know, I guess I, you know, I did fall into that. So
yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Someone else? So this Saturday is the third in the series of the current level one that's happening. The following Saturday is the fourth. And the Saturday after that, we're offering how to give the adult attachment interview, which is a class on how to actually give the interview. That's interesting. If you're not a practitioner of the interview, it may also be interesting to begin to get a sense of how attachment expression manifests and how it's understood. And that's a single day long. We have a level two, I think, starting in September. If the level two series is of interest to you, take a look at it. That stuff is all on the website. I offer the teachings freely, but I do hope that you'll consider making a donation. There's a link on the website to do that. It helps support me and also the work that Meta Group is doing. really appreciate your practice. Thank you for coming, and we'll see you soon, I hope. Bye.
Bye.